This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Early voting is underway in the runoffs for races that weren't decided outright in the March primaries. Today, we're talking with the two candidates that rose to the top in the race to become the Republican on the November ballot in the race to fill the 19th congressional district seat. Abraham Enriquez came in second in the March primary. He edged out the third-place finisher, Matt Smith, by 0.2%. That's just 186 votes. He's now working to capture the voters who originally backed one of the five others who didn't make the runoff. KACU's Heather Claiborne spoke with both Abraham Enriquez and Tom Sell. We'll start by hearing from Mr. Enriquez.
Mr. Enriquez, thank you for taking the time to return to the West Texas Dispatch.
Thank you, Heather, for the invitation. It's great to be back.
Well, I want to start by looking at the endorsements in this race. In March, the other candidates who didn't make the runoff, most of them threw their support to your opponent, Mr. Sell. But you've got some big names on your side, Governor Abbott, several elected and former elected officials, including former mayors of Abilene, Gary McCaleb and Anthony Williams, and current Abilene School Board member Billy Enriquez. What do you think these endorsements mean?
You know, I think they're reflective of where you're going to stand on policy and your touch with the community. We have the leading figures in Texas as well as local leaders, and I think that that says something about our leadership.
Neither of you can claim the endorsement of President Trump, but both of you have emphasized your ties to the president. Tell us about how you align with the president's policy goals.
What does it say that out of every race in Texas on the federal side, this is the only race as of yesterday that the president has not weighed in? And my opponent has spent the last 30 years of his career in the D.C. establishment world and has moved every machine, every arm, every bit of power that he can to lobby for that endorsement, and yet it still hasn't hit his way. And here you have a West Texas guy that has stood with President Trump since day one. And I think that says something. And when the special assistant to the president, Brett Powell, and director of the Office of Public Liaison of the White House, comes to Abilene and campaigns for you, she spent a whole day with me in Abilene, I think that says something about how we are the Trump-aligned candidate.
Are there any particular policy areas where you see yourself standing apart from President Trump and his approach?
Oh, Heather, I would say this man is someone who not once, not twice, but three times survived an assassination attempt. This is a man that understands that for long-term economic growth, we have to have some short-term pains in all areas to cut regulations, to cut establishment rule, to cut lobbying influence. So I'm with the president, 100%. And I'm with him because I have seen over the past decade that sometimes in policy areas, it might not make sense to most, but at the end, he always gets the best deal for America. And I've learned to stick with good leadership that way. My opponent on the debate said that, you know, there's areas where he would like to disassociate himself from the president. I do not.
Well, while you haven't run for office before, you have, as we've been speaking about, been working on policy for a few years now. What do you think you've learned from working on the USMCA and other policies that would, I guess, go with you to Washington if the voters end up picking you to head off in the midterms?
There's a new wave of Republican leadership that believes in getting out of big, you know, think tanks and big consultants and big lobbyists from cubicles in D.C. that are telling lawmakers how to shape policy and bringing the people of the community back into the conversations. A very specific example I can say is when President Trump was in the conversations of renegotiating USMCA, he didn't want all these commerce organizations or trade associations to come in and tell him how to do that. He wanted to hear it specifically from the private sector. So when we get to D.C., we're going to cut out the role of the establishment think tanks and lobbying and consulting groups, and we're going to really put in the people of our community. When we're talking about a farm bill, I want to know what West Texas farmers and ranchers are talking about. Anything on education, I want to hear from exactly from school teachers from our community. About religious freedom and education, I want to hear from our pastors. And I think that that's what sets me and many of these new wave of Republican members of Congress is that we want the real people, we want real voices to be shaping real policy.
How do you see yourself working in D.C. with the other policymakers? And particularly, how would you see yourself working across the aisle? Is that something that is achievable in D.C. in this moment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've already been doing that for the past 7 years. Yesterday I celebrated a year of working closely with the Office of the First Lady of the passing of the Take It Down Act, which protects minors and individuals from internet activity and slander, something that I've personally experienced on this campaign trail, and also allocates resources to the foster care system. That act could not have been pushed across the finish line had it not been for reaching across the aisle. Contrary to popular belief, you don't have to be a registered lobbyist, and you don't have to give to Democrats to get the other side to come into the table to negotiate. Because the other side, they're still good people that still want good for their community. And I've been doing that for the past 7 years. And I think that, yeah, we might disagree on maybe 99% of things with the other side. But on the 1% that we do agree, we lean in, and we lean in heavily, and we're able to come back to our communities, both sides, and say that we provided results for our district.
Well, when you get to the runoff, the key part is finding ways to differentiate yourself. What are the differences that you think are brightest between the two of you?
Well, I mean, he canceled three debates after our last televised debate. In fact, he canceled the only live debate that we were going to have in Abilene. So that should tell you something about that. Quite honestly, Heather, I don't know where my opponent stands on certain issues. He gives legal roundabout and legal jargon to every single issue that is so broad and not laser focused. So when it comes to the border, when it comes to immigration reform, when it comes to standing for life, when it comes to our farm bill, when it comes to water rights, when it comes to data centers and AI investment, I don't know where he stands. But with me, I've given every single policy push a clear, consistent message that it is for the people of West Texas. If it's good, then it's good for us. And I've been focused on that.
Well, if you've got 1 minute to talk to the voters, what is that kind of elevator pitch of why they should check your box on the runoff ballot?
At the end of the day, this is about the American dream. Who doesn't want to achieve the American dream? I am a grandson of immigrant farm workers that is on the Republican primary runoff in deep red West Texas. If I can make it this far, what does it say about the next generation of freedom fighters and what they can do? So in this runoff election, I ask voters to vote for someone that has been a part of the community. Born in Lubbock, Texas, a graduate of Abilene Christian University, this community has been home my whole life. And because it's been home my whole life, I will fight for it with every breath in my lung. And I hope to earn every single vote in this runoff and on Election Day next Tuesday, May 26th.
Well, Mr. Enriquez, thank you again for being part of the West Texas Dispatch.
Thank you so much, Heather. I appreciate you.
That was KACU's Heather Claiborne speaking with Abraham Enriquez by Zoom. She also spoke with the other remaining candidate in the race, Tom Sell. He is also a newcomer to campaigning. Sell finished the primary in first place, but the 40% of the vote wasn't enough to claim victory outright. Here's their conversation.
Mr. Sell, thank you so much for coming in to the West Texas Dispatch.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you very much.
I want to start by asking you about endorsements. You picked up several members of Congress, community leaders, yeah. Agribusiness. Yeah. In March, most of the other candidates put their support behind you. How important do you feel those endorsements are?
It's very important. And I love that our endorsements are, one, from sitting members of Congress who want kind of constructive representatives and members who will be a part of kind of building coalitions to advance good policy. But the fact that the other competitors, Jason Corley, who finished fourth, and Donald May, who is a strong veteran and great kind of intellectual in this, Ryan Zink, they've all jumped in. And Matt Smith has also, he's a good friend. He's become a really good and trusted friend throughout the first balloting. So I'm really honored to have, as a former competitor, to have their endorsement.
Neither you nor Mr. Enriquez has grabbed the endorsement of the president. Right. He came out this week to endorse Ken Paxton in the Senate race. Okay. Were you hoping to get that endorsement?
I think this region is so very Republican as a Trump, plus 26 district that we didn't really expect the president to get in early. Mr. Enriquez has been talking a lot about that. And of course, he boasts often about his ties to the president. I, of course, have a lot of strong ties in Washington, D.C., more in the Congress. To me, what's most important is that people see as we get around that we'll be a true and honest and credible, trustworthy voice for the people of this region.
Do you feel like there are any areas that you align more closely with the president than Mr. Enriquez, or any areas that you stand apart?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think certainly just kind of the experience in working through the details and kind of the the art of the deal, if you will, in terms of getting achieving policy goals in Washington, D.C. That's what I've had a career in a lot of ways. It's my kind of depth with a law degree and understanding how this process in Washington, D.C. works from my time way back when I was working for Larry Combes, mm-hmm. who represented the 19th District. I was with him toward the latter part of his career from 95 through 03. He was his right-hand man when he kind of became the chairman of the Ag Committee, working alongside another representative from the big country at that time, Charlie Stenholm, who was the ranking Democrat on the committee at the time. So I've seen this process of how to get from point A to point B, how to get from idea to enactment in Washington, D.C. In that sense, I really appreciate President Trump's ability to plant a seed of an idea and see it to fruition. And I want to be a big help in that. And I think it's that experience and that kind of credibility that really sets me apart in this race.
As you were talking about your time in D.C., was there something that you hold up as like the takeaway from that time that you think would be particularly helpful? You know, you mentioned the idea of planting seed or seeing things through to completion. Was there something that you feel like this is the thing that set me up to do this job?
That's such a good question. It's about cultivating ideas and cultivating a level of commitment from your would-be partners to kind of join with you in trying to advance this idea. I had a master class with Larry Combes back in the day, and Charlie Stenholm for that matter. There's a formula for getting things done. One, you got to be steeped in the details, know all sides of an argument. Two, you got to figure out how to kind of win people over. And this is kind of a lost art in Washington, D.C. sometimes right now. Too often, you'll see politicians just trying to throw them under the bus. And I think what a true statesman and representative needs to do is to win them over. We need more of that in Washington, D.C. these days. We have too much just of this kind of performance artist out for your own glory or some viral videos, something like that. And you know, people try and the media tries to kind of speak to people's worser angels in a way. I think we need more people in Washington, D.C. who are actually going to take the time and care to get deep into the material, be principled, you know, firm on where you stand, but also just work overtime to win people over to this point of view. And I believe Washington, D.C. needs more West Texas. It's about bringing this West Texas values and point of view to the people in Washington, D.C.
When you get to the runoff, really the key is differentiating yourself from the last remaining opponent.
Yeah.
What are two or three things that you see are clear differences between you and Mr. Enriquez?
The first I'd say is experience. You know, actually having done things like, you know, being married, raising a family, you know, paying property taxes. These things that ordinary Americans are trying to deal with, and they're not easy. And you grow in maturity and wisdom with that kind of experience. So I think that's the first thing. The second would just be credibility. I've always put, you know, clients and others first. We've built a successful business, and all that just kind of builds into this credibility. We are what we say we are. We don't try and overstate what we are, but we know how to get things done, and we know how to work and build people's confidence in us and build relationships that have served us well over time.
What's an issue that's got your attention right now?
There's a big issue with AI data centers right now. I just want the listeners to know that I think we bring a lot of expertise to the table. We live in a great state in Texas that honors people's rights and private property rights especially. But we've got to have a great level of communication so that we can protect our long-term resources and continue to build upon them, steward them so they can continue to be productive for generations to come. We also have to protect our ratepayers so that the ratepayers for electricity are not subsidizing the hog down the street that's using all the energy. These AI data companies have to bring energy production to the table. So there are so many issues that I've gotten to listen to and confront. Rural healthcare is also an issue that I just think really has to have a lot of attention. And we're really diving in and hope to be a real champ on those issues for our vast and productive 19th District of Texas.
So my last question for you.
Yeah.
As a businessman, I'm sure you've given many an elevator pitch. If you've got 60 seconds to tell the people why they should vote for you, what's your pitch?
Yeah, thank you for that opportunity. Man, I love this region. This 19th District is truly special. I'd just say, who do you trust? If you're concerned about the issues that are confronting our nation, enemies from without, enemies from within, if you agree with me that the issues they're confronting our nation bear a lot of gravity, right? They're very serious. If you want someone who embodies the values of the people of West Texas, not just in talk, but in actual looking at kind of this book of life that we've built over our career, then I think I'm the clear choice to represent the people and to be a good, honest, and true voice for our future. This is about passing it on to our kids and our kids' kids better than it was passed to us. And that's the ethic that I'll bring to the table and work hard every day to do that for the people of West Texas.
Well, Tom Sell, thank you so much for coming in.
I really enjoyed being with you today. Thanks for the opportunity.
That was KACU's Heather Claiborne speaking with Tom Sell, who's in the runoff for the Republican nomination for the 19th Congressional District. You can find previous conversations with both Mr. Sell and Mr. Enriquez on our website, kacu.org. Early voting, by the way, continues through Friday. Election Day is next Tuesday, May 26th. This is the West Texas Dispatch. The U.S. observes Mental Health Awareness Month every May. KACU's Josiah Wannell is examining how Texas is reshaping the way the justice system responds to mental illness with a series entitled Minds on Trial. In the first three episodes, we heard from judges, legislators, and scholars, people who built systems designed to catch people in crisis. In episode four, we step inside what that crisis actually looks like, not from the courtroom, but from a kitchen table. This is the story of Eric Smith and the people who love him.
His name is Eric Smith. He lives in San Antonio, Texas. He is an international business consultant, a public speaker, a commissioner with the Texas Judicial Commission on Mental Health, and a board member of the Schizophrenia and Psychosis Action Alliance. He is the kind of person you would be glad to have in any room. He is also a high school dropout who was once living out of his car, convinced he had been recruited as a federal asset to prevent the assassination of two world leaders. Both of those people are the same man, and the distance between them is the story of what this series has been trying to explain. To understand what happened to Eric Smith, you have to start where he started.
Elementary school. These were, without question, the golden years of my earlier life. I was studying piano, making great grades. I was handpicked when I was a young man living in San Diego in elementary school to be on the student council. It was just two people per class, so it was quite an honor to be selected for it from the teachers. And I was very active. I had a lot of friends. In short, like, my parents could have just high-fived each other and said, wow, we're killing it as parents. Look how well things are going with our son, Eric.
The grades slipped in middle school. Then, in high school, the Fs came. The school asked the right questions. Is there conflict at home? Is he using drugs? And got the right answers. But no one asked the question that mattered.
I don't think it was on anybody's short list that it was serious mental illness that was bubbling up and becoming a thing. But that is what was happening.
Eventually, Eric's parents had him tested. After several hours of standardized evaluation, a clinician called the family into his office.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith, your son's answers are consistent with that of a person diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And don't be surprised if he falls ill with some sort of psychosis by his mid-20s. That sounded insane to me at the time.
That is exactly what happened. The years between the warning and its fulfillment were not quiet. Eric dropped out of high school, earned a GED, attempted college, got hired by a Fortune 200 company where he consistently ranked among its top performance, all while battling a substance use disorder that was itself, in part, a response to symptoms no one had yet fully named. By his mid-20s, sober and living alone, something else began.
It was paranoia first, and then it was people are watching me next, and then it was, you know, where are their cameras that, like, I don't know where they're at, but, like, I'm definitely being watched.
In the early days of social media, when Twitter had maybe 15,000 users worldwide, Eric began to see patterns in the messages that were not there. Famous musicians were responding to his posts. World leaders were appearing on the same platform. And then, in the architecture of those early tweets, he became convinced he had found something no one else had seen.
And I felt like I stumbled onto a code that I had broken that was about assassination attempt plots that were specifically going to happen to our then president Obama and the Queen of Jordan to destabilize the West and start World War III. So I did what any sane person would do, which I am saying sarcastically. I Googled the FBI's phone number and I called them to tell them that I had broken these codes and there was going to be assassination attempts of these two world leaders.
The FBI met with him multiple times. He showed up with a yellow legal pad's worth of evidence. He brought diamond rings he had acquired, believing the government was bankrolling his efforts. He sat in the FBI's offices in San Antonio, tears running down his face, and explained to the agents why they were now going to have to kill his family.
Well, I'm an asset working for you guys now, and now that I'm that, if ever I have family around that's still alive, they could get captured and kidnapped and used as leverage against me so that I'm spilling out the secrets. So isn't that just how it goes? Don't you just kill the families of everybody that are the assets?
The agents asked, delicately, whether he was diagnosed with any mental health conditions, whether he was taking any prescribed medications. Eric heard what they were really saying.
I'm not stupid, I'm psychotic. So at the time, I start getting furious. I'm like, I know what they're getting at. They're trying to tell me I'm a crazy person.
And then his mind completed the circle. The FBI must be in on it too. They were trying to get him to stop, but he would not stop. While Eric was moving through this world, living out of his car, speeding down the highway convinced he was outrunning spies, meeting with federal agents he believed he was directing, his parents were making phone calls, doing the only thing they knew how to do, which was everything. Eric's mother remembers what those years looked like from the outside.
I was wondering, would my super intelligent, genius son ever be able to form a sentence? It was really, I can cry thinking about it now because it was devastating. And all the medications, all that were tried, and they'd work for a little while and then they didn't. And it was a hard road.
The first response, as with many families, was disbelief.
There was denial, quite honestly, at the very beginning of that.
That's true.
We became desperate going from psychiatrist to psychiatrist and Eric being rejected as a patient. What do we do? We're not giving up on him.
Eventually, Eric's most recent psychiatrist, the one who had fired him as a patient for being too difficult to treat, got on the phone with his parents and told them something shocking.
Do you have to have your son arrested for a low-level nonviolent offense? We were at a crossroads in our mind to where we have to do something.
But it was almost a relief.
It became a relief.
This is going to...
But it did not relieve the feeling you saw of your son being led away in handcuffs.
Eric was charged with trespassing. He was handcuffed. He went willingly because he believed, in his certainty, that federal assets outrank local police and that the government must need him in jail for a reason. Inside the jail, Eric was placed in solitary confinement. Not because he was dangerous in any conventional sense, because the other inmates refused to be around him.
The bulk of my stay while I was in jail, I was thrown in solitary, specifically because all the other real scary dudes around me were like, yo, we don't want to go to sleep around Eric. We don't want to be around him. This guy is like, he's saying some wild stuff. And so I was thrown in solitary because other people didn't feel safe around me. That is how different of a person I am when I am not medicated for my symptoms, that the truly scary people are afraid of me. It's totally backwards.
His parents begged the jail not to release him.
Because Eric, he would have been released to the streets because he had no prior convictions, nothing, no arrests. There was nothing on his record ever. And they were going to release him.
When his parents pushed and asked what the plan was for his care upon release, the jail's response was simple.
Well, you know, when Eric gets out, he can panhandle. He could use that money to, you know, get meds or whatever it is he needs, and he can sleep under a bridge, which is not a discharge plan for psychosis. It's not a discharge plan for any medical condition and definitely not a discharge plan for psychosis.
Then a judge heard about the case. A court liaison was sent to the solitary wing. She couldn't get into where Eric was being held. She stood on the other side and talked to him through the barrier. Eric remembers her to this day, and the specific words she used.
Eric, you know, I'm here from the hospital and there's some energy about you at the hospital and we're just trying to figure out, you know, do you belong in jail or do you need some help? Because some people might belong in jail, but is it you? Do you need help? Is this a medical thing?
The court liaison went back, and what happened next changed the trajectory of Eric Smith's life.
I was plucked from jail and I was transferred to the San Antonio State Hospital, where I stayed for 3 months involuntarily. And after those 3 months, I was stepped down into AOT for the first time.
He was placed in a conference room, not a courtroom. Around a table sat a psychiatrist, a social worker, a defense attorney, a court attorney, and a judge. Judge Oscar Kazin was not wearing a robe. He was there in ordinary clothes at one end of an ordinary table with a simple question. What does this person need?
And it was the absolute first time that I had ever seen authority used in a way that wasn't there to punish.
For 10 years, every doctor, every counselor, every judge had operated in a separate lane. Here, for the first time, they were all in the same room, working from the same facts towards the same goal. On Eric's behalf.
There was this judge talking to this treatment team for the benefit of me, and I had never had that experience before, and it really cut through the heart of things.
Something shifted. Not all at once, not without resistance, but something shifted.
I was like, you know what? I am going to take the meds.
Judge Kazin has sat at thousands of those tables. He has seen illness arise at every income level, every neighborhood, every family structure. He has one way of describing what it does to the people surrounding the person who is sick.
When mental illness strikes, it strikes anyone. It's like a dark creature coming out of a closet in the middle of the night. It is a hand grenade that goes off and the shrapnel hits everyone. It destroys serious mental illness, untreated mental illness, destroys the human soul that's suffering it. It knocks the family member standing next to them completely off their heels.
He has a particular tenderness for the parents. He has watched them arrive in his courtroom carrying something no one told them they didn't have to carry.
I have never met one that hasn't, in the middle of a dark night, looked up at the ceiling and stared and wondered and asked themselves, what did I do? What could I have done different? How did I cause this?
His answer to that question is always the same.
Understand, this is not your fault. Your son or daughter would be exactly in this position, whether you were an angel or the devil herself. This is not your fault.
And his motto, the one he tells every person who sits across from him at the table, is the clearest distillation of what the system is supposed to be for.
I'll tell them, you may fail the system, but I'll be damned if I let the system fail you.
Eric Smith's mother found her own version of that assurance, not in a courthouse, but in a phone number.
It was supportive for us because we know we could call. We did have Judge Kagan's phone number, and he took my call. I called many times, and he was there. I can't imagine if it hadn't been Judge Kagan.
Eric Smith went through the AOT program 3 times.
To get to where they need to be, Eric was not an immediate success, all right? He went through my program a couple times. We had to keep pulling him back and getting him to a point where wellness became his habit. But he's an example of many.
My parents essentially forced to wear de facto hats of like pharmacist, social worker, psychiatrist, counselor, because society just wasn't prepared to meet my needs. And so my parents were forced into this position that nothing they could do could really help until AOT came into my life.
Eric Smith does not describe what happened to him as a miracle. He describes it as a consequence of a system that, at a critical moment, chose to treat him as a person rather than a problem. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
Systems respond to crises. They rarely get ahead of them. Episode 5 of Minds on Trial asks the harder question, what has to change in the way we think about mental health before someone ever reaches that point? Tune in next week for the next episode entitled The Deeper Issue. Previous episodes, by the way, available on demand at kacu.org. The series was produced with assistance from the Public Media Journalists Association Editor Corps, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by you, the American people. It's time for West Texas Roots. Growing up on a West Texas farm may not seem like a lot of fun to people, but for those who did, they wouldn't trade it. With not a lot of options for entertainment, the key was to find ways to amuse yourself. Regina Davis tells us how she and her sisters would find ways to entertain themselves by riding a horse in the field or sitting in the shade of a tree. She also explains what her parents did for a living while she was growing up.
Oh, we were very laid back. I mean, my parents, my mother was an RN, my dad was a farmer my whole life. He had like, I know, over 880 acres, but more around the Jones County area, so I can't really tell you how much he had, but quite a bit. I mean, he did maize, cotton, he had cattle and things, and he could, where the dirt road was at, my dad could open up one side of the gate, lay down the other gate, and the cows would cross fields. It's like they knew that they had to cross over. They know that, like, my dad could pull up in a truck, and he had an ooga horn, they'd go, ooga. And half the time, I'd have to use it. They would just come running when they'd see him. We had a man that was leasing it from my dad, and then we all got together, and Daddy, we ended up selling it to him. So we just did that not long ago. Yeah, so it turned out good. It was three girls, and let me tell you, we are like 18 months apart, and then my mom, then my poor daddy, but that's probably what made him a good, strong man. But my sisters and I would ride on a swayback black horse and just jump on her, you know, with just a rope and go across the field to check on my dad while he was plowing and things. And we'd just hang out at the field and play and under a big, huge trees. And we'd just hang out till he'd come over there with the tractor and give us a drink of water. My dad would take us with them. We would maybe pick the turn rows on the cotton, did a little bit of hoeing and stuff like that, but not really driving the tractors. I guess, I don't know if he just, I don't know why we really didn't. Now, we did pull the cotton trailers when my dad would fill it. When we got up, we would pull the cotton trailers. And you could do that back then as long as you were working. You didn't have to be 16 to drive the vehicle. So we were like 12 and 13. Hauling in cotton for my dad and then go back out and get another trailer. We did do that. And then drive the grain truck. He would fill the grain truck up, and it's three on the tree. So that's how we learned to drive those. He did up until his mom, my grandmother, passed. And then I was the only one left. I was the youngest of the three girls. And then me and my mom talked to him because he was trying to be an electrician when he was in school after his dad passed at a young age, and he came back to farm. So my mom and I talked him into going back and becoming an electrician, which he did. Had his own business for a while up until he retired. He used his last name, which is Bauckham, Bauckham Electric. The guy that worked with him, he took it over, but yeah, changed the name, I'm sure. Oh my goodness, I think 42, something like that, years. Yeah, she was a teacher of LVNs too. Yeah, so, but it was in Anson. She probably just had like a half a dozen students, and she taught them to go on, don't just be an LVN. LVN. She said, I have a feeling you won't do like you're doing now, you'll just be an aide. And they all did, they all became something even higher than her. One of the guys became like, he ran a huge hospital. And then other ones, you know, worked in the surgery, and others became RNs and things like that. She actually went to school at Hendrick because they had her picture is still there from graduation. We call it the honeycomb area, and that's where she's at. Yes, her picture's still there. So she had to have been in her 20s, I would say, when she was going. and then married my dad and then graduated and went to, she worked at Hendrick for a while and then went to work in Anson. It was such a small, well, not small, so then they, back then they delivered babies and things at the hospital too. So she delivered, I know, a couple of babies on her own till the doctor got there.
We recorded Regina Davis's story of what her parents did for a living at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Years of fundraising and planning and renovating culminated in the grand opening of Abilene Heritage Square over the weekend. The project preserves parts of the city's past while creating space for learning, gathering, and creativity in a former high school building. KACU's Allison Diaz has more.
On Saturday, community leaders, families, and even visitors from out of town showed up to celebrate the grand opening of Abilene Heritage Square. The Texas Trails Council raised the American flag to open the ceremony, accompanied by the playing of the national anthem by Abilene High School. After the recognition of key individuals to the mission and work of the project, Abilene Mayor Weldon Hurt described what he sees as the positive, lasting impact that the Heritage Square will have on the community.
You know, this is more than a building. This is preserving a landmark that will be here long after we're gone. You know, my youngest grandson is here today, and I can't wait to hear him tell stories to his children because he was here on the first day.
This mammoth undertaking began more than 15 years ago. Once construction began, it took nearly 3 years and almost $80 million to complete. Board President Jane Beard says organizers worked passionately to build support and ended up creating the finest public space in the big country.
The renovations were all privately funded. No bond issues were passed and no tax dollars were used. So every single brick, pane of glass, auditorium chair, drinking fountain, and inch of wiring is here because someone believed in this project and contributed to make it happen. Abilene Heritage Square is quite simply a gift from citizens to their fellow citizens.
The ribbon-cutting ceremony was led by the executive board of Abilene Heritage Square, alongside leaders from the Grace Museum and Abilene Public Library, with special participation from several children in the community. Shortly after the doors were open, volunteers then unveiled an owl sculpture by KT Taylor titled Inspiration Takes Flight. As visitors funneled into the various entrances of the main building, the excitement was electric. Heritage Square is the new home for the main branch of the Abilene Public Library. When visitors made their way into the space, many paused to look up, standing in awe of the colorful three-story glass hanging sculpture by Dallas glass artist Carlin Ray. During the self-guided tours Saturday, guests were delighted by all the thoughtful details and elements throughout the library spaces. It's filled to the brim with shelves of books, cozy sitting areas, hands-on maker kits for children to learn new skills, puzzle sets, and totes with sets of books in them labeled Book Club in a Box. The excitement of exploring the fun features of the new three-story library didn't distract fourth grader Cece Cockrell from finding her first book to check out.
I'm just going to get this, The Ghost Rider by Julia Clark. Oh, I've just been waiting for a while. I can't even count the years.
Cece may not be counting the years, but for local preservationists, counting the years is part of the reason to celebrate. This project not only creates a new home for the public library and establishes a new science center tied to the Grace Museum, it preserves an important architectural piece of Abilene's history. Famed architect David Castle began work on the late Gothic Revival-style building in 1923. As visitors walk through the front doors and climb the stairs, they'll encounter exhibits telling the building's history, first as Abilene High and later as Lincoln Middle School. They can also learn about the restoration of the Owen Hall Auditorium. Heritage Square also provides a special connection point for parents who once learned inside these walls to now share the newly configured space with their children. Kim Castorino attended Lincoln Middle, which closed in 2007. She described her excitement not only to walk down memory lane, but hopes to explore the options available in the new event spaces.
I think it's pretty neat to bring my kids and show them a part of the school, and then to have a venue to maybe possibly celebrate at. My daughter's quinceañera is coming up, so kind of want to check out and see if it was something that maybe we could use.
Deep within the children's wing of the library, there is a reading room that transports the minds of children into a fairy tale forest with cozy reading spots shaped as leaves. Carolyn Santner traveled from Austria to attend the grand opening. She was impressed with the work her cousin, president of the executive board of the project, Jane Beard, helped to lead.
It's marvelous what's been done. And the idea of the forest and with the leaves and all, the nooks, it's just marvelous. The colors that are used, which really all of the senses are stimulated.
Not only does Heritage Square impress visitors, it also evokes pride in the hearts of alumni like Stan Hamilton, who attended Lincoln Middle School. He took in the changes with tears in his eyes.
It's just almost unbelievable. They almost tore this place down, and now it's a showplace. I'm so proud of it.
And did Stan feel nostalgic upon entering the historic building?
Oh, about everything. That's the outside walls right there. The way they've added onto it and then it matches so well, you would think it was built that way. It's hard to believe. I'm not surprised by the number of people that have shown up for this.
So many people showed up that the line stretched outside of the Sparks Center for the first few hours it was open. Every 45 minutes, a new group of visitors was allowed in to view the immersive, educational, and hands-on science exhibits that are an extension of the Grace Museum. Those tours were free, but going forward, visitors will need to buy tickets to enjoy the Sparks Science Center, which is open from 10 a.m. until 5 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday. The library, which is free to the public, opens at 9 a.m. Monday through Saturday. Information about rental spaces such as the auditorium, classroom, or courtyard is available on the Abilene Heritage Square website. I'm Allison Diaz in Abilene.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. And if your friend isn't able to tune in Wednesdays at noon, you let them know. They can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can find it also on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, with producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Our digital editor is Calvin Claiborne. J.C. Gamble wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.